Hello, everybody, and welcome to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley. I am joined for this very special Best of 2011 F This Movie by Doug.
I see you.
And JB.
Three cheers for the red, white, and blue. To live in a country where we have the freedom to see movies whenever we want, could we just join hands and thank God?
We're talking about our favorite movies from 2011. Today, and finally, putting a nail in that coffin of a year.
Is that joke about the Polish trilogy, the Red, White, and Blue? Is that the... No?
No, I'm...
Chris, what's his name?
Krzysztof Kozłowski.
Krzysztof Kozłowski.
I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm
free. Once again, you're listening to F This Movie, which you can find at fthismovie.blogspot.com. You can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/fthismovie. You can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/fthismovie. Find us in the iTunes store by searching F This Movie or
F This Movie on Google.
It's all pretty much
But then
I wouldn't be able to say all this every week. DVDverdictPresents.com. And thank you to Bradley Lang and everybody at Modern Myth Media. I don't know if you guys are aware of this. There's a podcast called Modern Myth Media that everybody should listen to. It's about comic books.
I call it M-Cubed.
It's about comic books and comic book movies. And we've been talking about one another sort of for several weeks, and they did this very nice thing where they said, hey, all of our listeners should go like F This Movie on Facebook, and we got a big bump. So thank you, everybody
at
Modern Myth Media.
Did they have a Facebook page? Because we'll reciprocate, or have you already?
Everybody who likes F This Movie should like Modern Myth Media on Facebook. Well, I was going to do that. I was just about to say
it. I'm holding your feet to the fire, don't worry.
And when you say Facebook, do you mean the Facebook?
I mean the Facebook.
Okay. $1 billion.
This show obviously has been a long time coming because we've been publishing lots of 10 best lists. And last week we talked about overrated, underrated.
It's already March of 2012.
Bad movies. Yeah. Avatar 2 has already come and gone. I was trying to make your joke relevant.
Oh, my joke is relevant always. I see you.
The 3D in Avatar 2? Underwhelming.
I was actually going to read some 10 best lists from listeners like we did on last year's show, but I kind of decided not to do that. So I apologize to any of you who were expecting to hear your list read, but if you go to fthismovie.blogspot.com, there's a whole thread where you can share your list and read the lists of others.
Or just post it below this.
Or you can post it here, yeah, if you want.
And I thought the lists that our listeners have been posting so far are
our
interesting because we've noted that this year there's a lot more variety in Major Critics 10 Best List, but that last year there was this problem where it was the same 10 movies in a different order. Perhaps this is why people listen to the podcast and read our little musings, but the lists that people have been posting on our site are very much my list.
Yeah, I agree, and I think all of our lists have movies in common. And again, I think it's just because we all have maybe similar tastes, and that's
why we're
all friends.
I got a couple curveballs, so buckle your seatbelts, F-heads.
Or could it be that compared to the major print critics, the three of us have better shit detectors?
I think so.
All right, curveball number one. Doug, no strings attached.
No strings attached.
Number two, what's your number?
Not my number 10.
Number three.
You're going out of order.
Three, Moody.
Please do not say that no strings attached is on your list.
Have you seen it?
Yes.
There are no strings attached.
We all saw it together.
Oh, and you know what?
On my birthday.
No, it was Erica's birthday.
Was it?
Yeah.
No.
Oh,
we know what we saw on
your birthday. Your
birthday
was
all ass.
We don't celebrate your birthday anymore because of that.
Why do we hate each other?
What?
Why do we hate each other?
Okay, here's the ritual. When it's your birthday,
what's the worst thing we can do?
Guys, for my birthday, come see The Dilemma.
On my birthday, we went to see Hall Pass, and then everybody punched me in the face. Which was better than the movie.
I gave John a hell pass. A pass to hell by punching him in the face.
If I had to choose between seeing Hall Pass again and getting punched in the face, that's an easy decision.
Hall Pass? Is the answer Hall Pass?
No.
I would totally choose Hall Pass again. I don't want to get punched.
Getting punched in the face hurts. Hall Pass was very funny. Very. He didn't like being married.
Notice, Patrick has his funny irony face.
They
wanted,
that's just my face. That's just my face. They wanted to have no strings attached.
Patrick has whatever that disease is that you're vitamin C deficient, so all he sees is orange.
Rickets.
Rickets.
Scurvy?
Scurvy. Scurvy. No, it's not rickets. It's scurvy. Patrick has scurvy, so he's attracted to orange things. He loves Jenna Fisher in Hall Pass. She is a bright orange.
Okay, so you noticed that too.
Everyone, yes, it was in your
she mentioned
looks
that.
Unhealthy. Absolutely, yeah.
Unhealthy. Let's talk about our favorite movies of 2011.
Let's get positive, gentlemen.
Remember, these are not necessarily the best, just our favorites. And by that, I mean the best. Douglas, would you like to start us off? I like to go from left to right, from right to left.
Number 10 is The Eagle. Listen. Listen, Channing Tatum is haywire in The Eagle. Haywire is an adjective I'm trying to make catch on. Patrick, can you ask me about Haywire?
Doug, tell me about Haywire.
Haywire is a movie in 2012 directed by Steven Soderbergh, starring Gina Carano. And it looks so awesome. I have a feeling it's going to be so awesome that I'm going to try to make Haywire.
It's already your favorite movie of 2012.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So this my list right of 2011, no reference to Haywire the movie. My list is Haywire.
Right.
Because it means
when
it's
something's
cool.
Like, that's totally Haywire.
It's totally Haywire.
Did you see what Tom Cruise was doing on that building?
Haywire.
That was totally Haywire.
In Mission Impossible, that movie is Haywire, and he was Haywire.
I am now afraid that all 10 movies on my list pale in comparison to the Haywire.
I fear that next year's 2012 best of list will just be Haywire in 10 spots.
And when you say Haywire, are you referring to...
Damn it, I've already lost it.
Are you referring to the Haywire?
My number 10 is not The Eagle. Because The Eagle is a movie that is already on HBO, and I pass it. I'm like, what is this? Oh, right, that preview I wanted so desperately
to end.
Wait,
you mentioned The Eagle. Are you referring to the Eagle?
I'm referring to The Eagle is, but that's code for bad. But not America. America loves Eagles.
Did
so.
You see that movie? Totally Eagle. Not at all Haywire.
Not at all Haywire. So my number 10, I hate to start the podcast like this. I'm the jokes aside, my number 10 is
I
a tie.
I never agreed to this. Oh.
And that sucks for America. But it's great for me because I can include 11 movies then. My number 10 is a tie between, wait for it, Tucker and Dale versus Evil.
Yes.
And Hannah.
Yes.
So I think those two movies are solid and have not been talked about enough. I know Mr. Bromley wrote about Tucker and Dale versus Evil on our website. I would encourage people to go read his review. It's not the most glowing review. It's positive, obviously.
Yes.
It's not the most glowing. The most glowing.
Right.
I said it twice.
I like Tucker and Dale a lot more than Patrick did.
And
it's not as if you hate it.
Guys, why am I under attack here? This is totally Eagle.
And we briefly mentioned it as being
underrated
for the year.
It's a great movie, and I want to put out there right now, and I'm realizing we're already 7 minutes in this podcast, and I should stop rambling. But any of these lists, and Patrick mentioned before, it's not the 10 best, it's our favorites, which is the best. And I really feel like my list is every entry is a movie that had a very visceral reaction in me and just such an enjoyable experience. There will be no Trees of Life on my list. There will be no Melancholias. Not that those are bad movies, although I haven't seen Tree of Life. But nothing about those movies impacted me or had personal touch on my private parts. And Tucker and Dale vs. Evil, I sat down, had no expectations, and it was so much fun and just a delight and funny and interesting, and I hadn't really seen something like that before, and it was great. And Hannah is underrated. It's not perfect. It's very flawed, but I really liked a lot of what they tried to do. I thought it was interesting. I thought the characters were pretty well drawn, and I enjoyed it.
It was one of those movies that came out kind of early in the year. It came out in, April. And the first couple months of the year, while there was plenty of garbage, as we've already mentioned, No Strings Attached, and Hall Pass.
And The Eagle.
But there were a handful of movies that came out early in the year where it was like, well, that wasn't perfect, but I haven't really seen that movie before. And
right.
Hannah was, in Sucker Punch, and there was a bunch, Source Code. There was a bunch of stuff that came out early on, and then the year got a little bit more despairing. But
right,
it sounds like you're sort of starting to do Kevin Nealon subliminal guy as you make a point and then say
quickly take it back.
Tucker and Dale almost made my list,
okay,
but it didn't because there were 10 movies that were better.
I can't argue with that logic.
You were one of the lucky people who actually got to see Tucker and Dale in a theater. Because
that's right.
It barely got released.
What was the occasion for that? It was. It was at the Portage Theater. It was Terror in the Isles.
One of the Terror in the Isles.
Same day we saw Sleepaway Camp.
Okay, that's right.
Thank you, Rusty.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And anybody who wants to see Doug's 10th or 11th favorite movie of the year, it is available on Netflix Instant right now.
That's awesome. And Hannah was great. Joe Wright, who made a bunch of British
snooze fest
garbage movies, he actually directs some decent action, and it's
he should
fun.
Have started including tiny Saoirse Ronan as an assassin in all of his movies. So she shows up in Pride and Prejudice and in Atonement.
That's right.
In that movie. Oh, come on.
Good gravy. So that was my picks. Number 10. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. I am out. See you later.
My number 10.
It's been haywire.
My number 10 I've been back and forth on over and over again, and I'm finally settling on Contagion, Steven Soderbergh's crazy disease movie from a few months ago that just came out on DVD and Blu-ray. I'm a huge, huge Steven Soderbergh fan. The guy is haywire. He made Haywire. And I just think it's a great, I love how sort of not romantic it is. It's just sort of this procedural. This happens, then this happens, then this happens. It gives you all these different sort of aspects of what it might be like when everyone gets sick and dies. It, you know, covers little families. It covers the CDC. It's all over the place. I was reluctant to see it because it seemed terrifying to me.
Yeah, now that you review, I can't wait to not see it because it still looks terrifying.
Especially in IMAX and in the trailers, you know, this isn't giving anything away because it's in every trailer, but Gwyneth Paltrow gets very sick very early and terrible things happen to her. And that's in the trailer, and I was like, I don't think I want to see that 10 stories tall.
Right.
So I avoided seeing it and caught up with it at home and was really blown away by just how well made it is. Some really good performances in it. Great, great score by, I think, Cliff Martinez, who also did the score for Drive.
Yes.
Which was another awesome score. I really, really liked it.
One critic said it was the scariest movie of the year.
That's probably true.
I would quibble with that in that I actually thought Marcy May Marlene was far scarier.
Sure.
But what I really admired about Contagion was, given the material, it could have been a lot more sentimental than it was.
Yes.
And it was bracingly unsentimental about some things, yes, considering this is an American film. But at times was wonderfully sweet and sentimental. I'm thinking of the do-it-yourself prom.
Right.
Which I thought was very affecting.
Yeah, and a lot of people accused it of being way too, like, sort of cold and clinical. But I don't think it was, because I thought it was in the right degree, and then other times it wasn't, just like you said.
There's a fate of one of the characters, I'm really going to avoid spoilers here, that's so cold and so abrupt, but then when you consider what that character's job is, that was always a possibility that was an occupational hazard.
And the last moment that character gets involves a blanket, and it's...
Yeah, this is too much spoiling. I feel like you're spoiling it. I really do. Like, I'm connecting the dots.
It's great. It's sort of this human spirit. Like, my last gesture is going to be to try and give this other person a blanket, even though I need it desperately.
Put this in layman's terms. It's kind of like the band playing on the deck of the Titanic. I got you.
Very much like that. They say, gentlemen, it's been a pleasure. Glub, 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 glub.
Are you making fun of me again?
No.
Did you? Unless you wrote and directed Titanic.
Okay.
Did you drown and come back to us?
Because I mentioned this months ago. That's the one moment in Titanic I like.
No, that's a good
the one moment Titanic that actually really happened.
I'm not even making fun of it, but I'm making fun of it to just like because it's so cliched at this point. When did that movie come out?
97.
So that's like 35.
Unless
years
you
ago.
Mean in 3D, and then it comes out in the future.
And oddly enough, the marketing people are all screwed up because this month it's all over Cinemax and Cinemax HD. And if I was about to release that in 3D,
right,
I would make it very difficult to see for.
Yeah.
At least a year. I don't know what they're thinking.
Yeah.
Well, the Cinemax screening will be a commercial.
Do you think that there's a study that proves that only 7 people subscribe to Cinemax?
I'll say this.
But it's the right thing.
I subscribed to Cinemax for a while. It didn't get so... It was pretty interesting for a while. Then it was less interesting during the day.
It was pretty interesting for a while. It was pretty interesting after 3 in the morning. And then at 6 in the morning, it got really boring.
I love that the preview for the Titanic re-release says, from the director of...
The visionary director of Avatar.
Avatar. And I'm like, no, it's the visionary director of the thing I'm seeing.
Right.
It's
remember when he was the visionary director of Titanic?
Right.
Before
Titanic.
That, the visionary director of True Lies?
And I'm not sure if this is my joke or Patrick's, but the trailer for Titanic 3D says, from the genius of James Cameron. And my thought was, I thought this was from The Genuine Tragedy. I thought that's where that story came
from.
That
is your joke, sir.
Okay.
But if you guys are quibbling, I'll take credit for it.
If we keep saying that word... I'm afraid.
Oh no, the quibbler!
And The Quibbler was so fucking stupid, we just never brought it back. It was such a stupid idea.
He's this podcast's Noid. That was on Super 8.
Okay.
Noid? I avoid the Noid. Am I avoiding the Quibbler?
Yeah, if you're interested in the Quibbler, listen to Super 8. This Quibbler ruined podcasts.
Your number 10, sir.
My number 10, and again, Mr. Bromley should be given the credit or the blame. I saw a lot of movies this year.
How many movies?
I'm so proud of this, and I don't mean Netflix, and I don't mean basements, and I don't mean TV, and I don't mean rentals. I'm talking about a movie theater where I paid admission. The final tally for the year is 156. Yes, folks, that's 3 a week.
That's effing crazy.
I'm very proud of that, but I'm only bringing this up as preface to the fact that I didn't see 11 movies. And here are 10 of them. So much of what I saw this year was so ludicrously bad that Patrick's recommendation sent me to this film, and I'm aware that it's flawed, but let's give it the Ambition Award. My number 10 film is Sucker Punch.
Yes!
Wow.
A film that stayed with me weeks after I saw it. Very few films do that anymore. A film that's full of ideas. You might disagree with the ideas or think that the ideas are exploitative and ugly and awful and sexist. I disagree. But again, you got to give them credit for effort. It's crazy to look at. I think it's got a lot of intelligent things to mull over. It was sort of amazing. I'm glad I saw it in IMAX.
Yeah, two quick things. I think just what you said before, how it stuck with you, I think that is, again, the theme of this podcast, being like how it affects you. And the stuff on my list, it's just stuck with me. I had scenes. And I think a lot of great movies can be great, and if they don't stick with you, what's the point, really?
Right.
And secondly, I like Sucker Punch so much, I can't wait to see Sleeping Beauty. So, Patrick,
do you remember your original review of Sucker Punch that you texted to me after you saw it?
I don't. No, I'm sorry.
What the fuck was that?
But in a weird way, sort of
crazy.
Sort of playing off.
And that's okay.
The name of our website. An odd way, shouldn't films do that more often?
Oh, yeah, I wish.
Because I still remember, tangent, the first time I saw Synecdoche, New York was at Ebertfest. I had never seen it before. And that movie spun me around. It took me days to get out of the daze.
I see what you did there.
Yeah, it's a little homonym thing going on right now. Go on.
That my original reaction to Synecdoche, New York was, what the hell?
Well, yeah. Ebert, that's one of his...
He says it's the best film of the decade.
And I have not... Is it on Netflix Instant? I would love to see it.
I don't believe it is. It was for a while. I still have not seen it
either.
Good
gravy.
I'm a failure. We talked about Sucker Punch last week on our... we said it was perhaps the most underrated movie of the year.
Got a lot of flack from that.
Yeah, some people were a little bit up in arms about the fact that we were championing that movie. And other people say, hey, thanks for going to bat for Sucker Punch, because I think other people are starting to feel the same way about it that we do. But again, if you are somebody who's just like, I hated that movie so much and it was just empty fanboy porn, sexist, misogynistic garbage. I mean, I can't say, like, see it again, it'll change your mind, but you just really have to consider what's going on a little bit beneath the surface. I think it got dismissed by so many people.
I thought, given the narrative of the film, it's fairly clear that the film is critiquing exactly what people are accusing it of being.
Right.
And I don't see why so many people are missing the point.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely wish, like you said, it's a mess, and I definitely wish that some of the ideas had been articulated a little bit better, or that the story kind of came together. It's really just like, here's a set piece, here's a set piece, here's a set piece. And it sort of adds up to these ideas, but as a movie, it doesn't totally work, you know? But, yeah, it's good. Everybody see it.
Yeah, absolutely.
See the longer cut if you can. It's slightly better. Number 9 for you, Douglas.
Now this is controversial. Battle Los Angeles. Listen. I'm kidding. Might do this for everyone.
That movie is so eagle.
That movie is very eagle. It's not haywire. Like my real number 9, Captain America: The First Avenger. That's my number 9 movie. I like it a lot.
And that's my number 9 movie too.
Neat. You guys should talk about it. I'm going to have a sandwich.
JB, what did you like about Captain America: The First Avenger?
Oddly enough, because I think this other film...
Patrick, keep your sandwich eating down.
I think this other film is on your list. so I'm going to avoid saying it. But for the longest time, and in fact, the list I showed you last week had the other film, I went back and forth because I thought there should be a place on the list for the film that was the most fun. And I went back and forth and back and forth and back and forth.
That's why I picked Contagion.
And finally today...
It was fun watching Gwyneth Paltrow die.
I'm talking to my son on the phone and I said, we're doing the podcast tonight. I can't decide between these two films. He said, quick, if you could see either one of them right now, which one would it be?
Captain
that's
America.
What made my decision? Captain America, the First Avenger.
I feel this is very kismet because we both like this movie and I actually saw it for the first time with you.
You both liked it just a little bit less than eight other movies, which is neat.
Also, it's one of the few movies this year I saw more than once in a theater. I wound up seeing Captain America three times.
Wow. Really? We saw it together at the patio in Chicago on the northwest side. A really nice,
second happiest place on earth.
It's really great, and the seats are kind of uncomfortable. But what do you want? It's an old theater. And
people
it's
in the 30s were built very differently. This is the conclusion I've made from the pay show, the music box, and especially the Virginia and Champaign. People in the 30s.
You think the Depression toughened them up?
Toughened their tuchus?
They were also tinier.
Yeah. Oh. I think they sat on their parasols, is what I think. Or maybe their hats, eh? I thought it was so much fun. I'm a fan of, if you've listened, and not to say you should know what I'm a fan of, because that's very pretentious. But I love war stuff, and I love specifically World War II, and I think that this being a superhero, and I'm not even the biggest superhero movie fan.
Yeah.
I never really read comics, but the mixture, I can't imagine, I'm sure this has been talked about all over the internets, I can't imagine... Captain America being a modern day thing. It's got to be a throwback, and they did that really well. Patrick, I know, has some big issues with the very, very ending.
Yes.
But Joe Johnston makes a movie that's really just a lot of fun, and you know.
The film has one of the most beautiful last shots of the year, and then the marketing people take over, and it keeps going. It's been out for so long.
Oh, yeah, spoil it.
They show a small boy in an alley pretending to be Captain America with a Captain America shield he's made out of the top of a garbage can. And in slow motion, in this beautiful New York street scene, we see him running away from the camera in slow motion. And it's elegiac, and it's just so beautiful.
And this is after the real Captain America has sacrificed himself and been frozen in ice. And it's like, look, his spirit lives on.
And it's very touching. And then in the spirit of AI... and Lord of the Rings, the films that end seven times, you have to keep going.
Well, it's this nonsense because they want to set up the Avengers, because the Avengers takes place in present day. So it's like, we have to explain how Captain America gets into present day New York.
No, because
the beginning of the movie does that.
Plus, you can do that at the beginning of the Avengers movie.
Or you could do it after the credits, if you have to do it. But, like, the movie opens with them finding the ship under the ice.
Yeah.
So we know that they found him.
Do you think, and I think that I know the answer, do you think, I mean, Joe Johnston, that was his ending. The boy
in
slow motion.
It's Joss Whedon directed the extension.
For real?
Yep.
I did not know that. That's crazy.
Patrick's right. It
Cabin
demands,
in the Woods?
It demands a fade-out. Excellent supporting performances. Great dialogue, the musical number in the middle that we've all referenced.
Yeah, something that I
thought it was the most entertaining movie of the year.
A movie that did not make my list is X-Men: First Class, and I liked that movie. I thought it was fun, but I think that Captain America does so many things right, and X-Men: First Class has some great, great scenes, and then cuts to what's Zoe Kravitz dancing in a butterfly
costume.
And
you had referenced this on the summer podcast. That one thing you can give Captain America credit for is that it kept it up throughout the entire movie. It was a very consistent movie from beginning to end. And as I pointed out, in X-Men First Class, you have a terrific opening.
Oh, jeez.
And then teen disco dance party, it all goes down the tube.
Right. And so Captain America, you should see it. It's been out for a while, I think, on DVD.
I am going to see it again.
it's great. It could have been so sort of corny, and it isn't. It's just sincere.
Right, sincere
that's
is
hard to do.
Yeah, absolutely.
And in a way, and I won't belabor this point, it seems to me that so many comic book movies take an arch ironic stance, and that Captain America might actually point the way to how comic book movies need to be done. Think about the first Iron Man, which was fairly straightforward, because comic book movies, almost by definition, are very...
Yeah, although I would argue that the first Iron Man movie, I mean, the Tony Stark character, sort of his default mode is...
But that's the character,
irony.
Not
right.
The film.
Okay.
That the film is... And the thing I point to is, and I think the reason why so many people liked it, the amount of time they spent in the cave on the backstory was sort of amazing by modern film standards. Oh, and he's got to build a heart, and he's got to overcome this. It was really good drama.
I didn't like, though, that in the – I didn't like that he had to create unobtainium, the element that keeps him alive.
That's Iron Man 2.
And it's also Avatar. It's not even the element he creates.
No, I know,
My joke is off the rails.
But I love that still you're – complain about Iron Man 2.
You can't create...
He invents an element.
You can't invent elements. You just can't do it. If they exist. You can't just invent an element.
At this point, physicist Doug speaks up.
Thank you.
He's putting his foot down, America.
By the way, just a quick side note, because you're not here with us, you don't have visuals. JB has grown a beard, and I think it's immaculate. I love it. You should keep that beard. It gives you a professorial, avuncular, not creepy, not like me. I'm a creepy uncle. I could smell my own. You look handsome.
At this point, I pause to stroke said beard.
Patrick, what is your number 9 movie?
My number 9 movie is, I think, the other movie that you were wrestling with, JB, and a movie that I'm thinking will come up again on this podcast, but it is Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol.
I am insulted that that is so low on your list, said
you are,
Doug.
You are correct.
Yeah.
That movie is nothing but great. It is haywire, that movie.
That movie is super haywire.
What do you think? Are you going to be shocked in February, mm-hmm. during the Academy Awards?
Right.
Will you be surprised when Tom Cruise, lead actor of Mission Impossible, wins all of the Oscars?
I will not, because this is a campaign that I have been enforcing since I saw Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol.
Tell us, what made you think this?
Tom Cruise is hanging outside the tallest building in the world by his bare hands, and the thought pops into my head, they should give him all the Oscars. And I'm sticking with that.
And the funny thing is, I think to myself, all the Oscars?
Best animated feature? Tom Cruise from Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol.
Because he was so much more animated than that. I'm on record. I am on record as not being being the farthest from a Tom Cruise fan that you can possibly be. The movie is so good. It made me like Tom Cruise a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll talk about it some more later. So let's
We will move on, Doug, to your number 8.
My number 8 is Friends with Bennett. I'm just kidding. My number 8 is Super 8.
I see what you did with the number in the name of the movie.
That's right. That's how I thought we were supposed to do it.
I thought we were ranking them in terms of excellence, not playing silly games.
My number 7 is The Magnificent 7.
Super 8
number
is...
6! With 6, you get egg roll!
Fast 5.
Fantastic Four?
3 and
number 1? The 1.
You can't just go to number 1. You've got to go 2 and 1.
No. My number 2, Lethal Weapon.
My number 8 is Super 8, directed by J.J. Abrams. I have a feeling this will come up 2 more times on this podcast, so I will say I loved it. It was fun and adventurous, and I have probably the biggest issue of the three of us with the ending, but even that being said, the ending, or not the ending, the stuff with the alien, I don't even care. It's great.
And the movie, be fair, you have the most issues of the three of us.
That's right. I twitch.
In general.
I've got the thing that has in the private area. It's spreading. If anyone is a doctor and would like to email fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, 2 words, milky discharge.
Well.
That's why they call me Doug, milky discharge. So let's, we'll just kind of
I thought that was what the MD after his name meant.
That's what I tell the ladies. I'm also in the FBI, John.
Is the middle word of that acronym by any chance? Boobs?
Close. Okay, so my number 8, Super 8, I'll kind of skip past it. We'll talk about it later.
We're back to me, right? Because you guys had a matchy match.
That's right.
My number 8 is War Horse, the Steven Thank you very much, Joey, making a guest appearance on the podcast. Joey the Horse from War Horse. He was going to get an Oscar, but Tom Cruise took it.
Guys, check it out. I am not a crook. It's all impersonations all night. Horses, Nixon, some
Nixon
weird
horse.
Wild stuff.
Johnny Carson Horse.
That's right.
It's everyone as a horse.
Does the horse in War Horse talk?
To me, but I don't think he was talking to anyone else. He told me to kill someone.
Wait, it was one of us, was it?
You'll find out at the end of the podcast.
If this were a mail carrier, I would be worried.
I was surprised how much I liked War Horse because the trailers looked very just corny and nonsensical and like a cell phone should ring. Steven Spielberg had two movies out this year. I saw Tintin. I wanted to like it more than I did. It was just okay. War Horse, I understand a lot of people roll their eyes. It's not going to be for everyone. And I won't even say
it is for everyone.
Well, definitely, yeah. But I think so many people now are just very resistant to like, oh, this is so...
A lot of critics really liked it,
It's overly sincere.
I've read a lot of glowing reviews.
Yeah, well, the thing is, it's like, it wasn't even that the story grabbed me or that the performances were, like, great across the board, because they're not. It has great moments. Honestly, what really made me really like it was just Steven Spielberg's direction. I watched it, and I think my comment afterwards was, watching that is like taking a class on how to make a movie. It's so old-fashioned, and that's one of the things I liked about it, too, is just that in 2011, when we're all sort of
cynical
and ironic and everything, that Steven Spielberg makes a movie that could have been made in the 40s.
There's scenes, I know we've talked about, I'm sure everyone's talked about it, like, Saving Private Ryan. I know you're not a fan, Patrick. I love it. The scene, the storming of Omaha Beach. How do you do that? How do you put that together? And right. I think a lot of there's elements of that in War Horse, too. There's scenes, the trench scene is probably the most famous in No Man's Land, but there's sweeping, and I give credit to Janusz Kaminski. I mean, it's unbelievable how he films this. I can't even wrap my head around where to even start the concept of, like, okay, there's going to be a battle. Go. It's up to you to make this come true.
Right. And in War Horse, I think even more than Saving Private Ryan, you know, Saving Private Ryan, the style calls so much attention to itself deliberately, but it feels like work. It's like, boy, they really worked hard on this. And War Horse feels kind of effortless. And that's always fascinating to me when Steven Spielberg can just hit these fucking home runs and just make it seem like it's absolutely nothing for him.
It's a point that I make sometimes in film class that if you think about it, there's an infinite number of places to put the camera, but there's only one best place to put the camera.
Right.
And that's very, very difficult to ferret out, and Spielberg is amazing when it comes to that.
Yeah.
You know, it's just one quick last thing I want to say about, in Saving Private Ryan, you said it's like work, and it's the whole, the way they shoot the action in the Omaha Beach sequence, and I realize it was, they're borrowing from the archival footage of the 16 frames per second, you know, very low tech cameras that they use. Right, absolutely. So they're mimicking these kind of diegetic things that took were in the 40s, and they're digitizing film and making it look a certain way. And Saving Private Ryan has changed it. I think we can all argue it changed action sequences for the next 10 years at least. Yeah. I remember seeing Gladiator in 2001. And there's sequences in Gladiator, which is about gladiators fighting in Germania, that it looks like Saving Private. It's like, no, they did that on purpose in a World War II thing because it
harkens a certain aesthetic.
Absolutely. Right. My point with War Horse is
That's how the newsreel footage of the ancient gladiators also looked.
Stone tablet.
Janusz Kaminski, it's the bird in the camera that's pecking out the stone, right?
It's a living.
Die, war bombs for Caesar!
All right, sorry. In War Horse, Janusz does a great thing. He finds a way to shoot, because there's no film, there's no moving, I don't think there's any moving picture film footage of World War I of the trenches, and he films it in such a way that I don't think I've seen the colors, how there's like, there's reds and grays and drab olive greens, and it's kind of blurry, and it has a dreamlike quality to it, and it's shooting action, and I've never seen that before, and I never felt lost also in the chaos of it. That was a really rambling, long thought. I apologize. But I like that stuff a lot. And the charge of the cavalry was an excellent sequence. I love when they pop out of the wheat and they run towards the Germans. It's really one of the best sequences I've seen in movies this year.
Yeah. Next for you, JB.
My number eight.
Yeah.
And again, I have Patrick to thank for this. Woo! I know Mike.
When are you going to start thanking me?
Never.
Jesus.
You suck. It's true. Look at this charge.
Mike saw it at Comic-Con and wrote a criticism of it. And I don't know what was going on. Did it play around here?
It played in one theater in Chicago for about 2 weeks.
Typical, because I wound up seeing it in Patrick's basement. And it's amazing in every sense of the word. And actually, at the end of the year, it is starting to get some critical acclaim.
Yeah.
It is, of course, the film Attack the Block.
Yes.
Which I would say is the best horror film of 2011.
Interesting.
Very interesting take on a trope that we've seen way too many times before. An interesting way with dialogue in some of the scenes where it almost sounds like it's been synced to the music track and they're rapping. Lately, it's very difficult to get a monster in a movie that doesn't seem to be based on two or three other monsters from 10 years ago.
Right.
And I got to tell you, the Attack the Block, whoever came up with that.
Right.
And well, I would actually say the monster in Attack the Block has an antecedent. I thought it was very similar to the Id monster from Forbidden Planet.
Okay.
Just colored in with the black crayon.
Do you think in Attack the Block it was like a budgetary issue too?
But it works. Oh, wow.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's actually agree.
It's real. It's not CGI. It's men in suits that has been digitized to look black, right?
Yeah, I believe so, yes.
It's
awesome.
It's an amazing
Talk
about fun on a budget, which every low-budget filmmaker will tell you. Not having money forces you to not have the monster from Super 8.
Right.
I loved it. I loved every frame of it.
It's great, and I think it's a movie that is now experiencing and did experience a little bit of backlash because it was so hyped up by sort of the internet community, the people who saw it at Comic-Con, or some of the movie blogger types who were just championing it.
I hate movie blogger types.
The second coming. And now
blogs is the worst.
People see it, and they're like, well, it's good, but it's not that great. And, you know, that's unfortunate that it's just... that you're measuring it just against your expectations.
No, it's
an outstanding movie. Yeah, it's really
good. It's a lot of fun. It almost made my top 10 list, but there were 11 better movies.
And you can watch it over and over again, too, which I think is kind of
neat. Quick. It's quick.
And it moves like crazy.
Yeah.
And the other thing I like, which not a lot of horror films do, and I'm not saying everything needs to have a moral, is that at the beginning we set up a situation where these people are really diametrically opposed, and one of the sub-themes of the film is as it goes along, they realize that they have to depend on each other. Mm-hmm. And the film really kind of, in a very subtle way, talks about community and what community is and why we need each other,
right,
which is a rare thing for a horror film to bring up.
Absolutely. It's great.
Next for you, Doug.
Okay. Controversial, maybe. The re-release of The King's Speech. Listen, it was so good last year.
Now let me get this straight. You liked it better without the F words.
Well, yeah, I thought the PG-13, I could take my kids.
No. I thought you
didn't need all that filth.
I thought you meant the 3D re-release of The King's Speech.
It was much better. His stammer in the third dimension.
Well, when he spit, it was more realistic.
My number 7 is Bridesmaids, directed by Paul Feig. Although, if you're going to go with the Germanic pronunciation, it should be Feig. E before I is like Seinfeld, Feig, but it's probably Feig. I also saw this at the patio. I think it might have been my first movie at the patio. And it was just really funny, and I kind of had no expectations, almost expecting a Hall Pass or Cedar Rapids or No Strings Attached or something, just like the next comedy, even kind of saddled with the SNL Kristen Wiig, and the movie was just it was delightful. And I'm actually, a lot of people I know, not this group right here, but family and other friends. I'm kidding. I have no other friends.
dog down the street.
They love the parts where the girls poo,
right?
And that is the worst part of the movie. I can't imagine that movie. It just like I actually think Melissa McCarthy is pretty great in it. With the exception of all that garbage of her crapping in a sink.
The revelation about what she's really like at the end
and
that she is committed to being Kristen Wiig's friend, I thought that's something we haven't seen in a movie before. I like that part a lot.
Yeah, I wanted that scene to be just a little bit better, and I can't even articulate why, but I was so ready for that scene to be so great and pull all these things into focus. And I mean, it did enough, but whatever.
Yeah, there's too much, you know, fart noises and pooing in the street. And it's just, whatever. I so dislike that stuff and have to roll my eyes. And I'm in a theater full of people laughing their asses off during that part. But I'm liking the end scenes and how awkward certain things are. And it's like they're not going for easy outs in a lot of, I mean, the end is a little easy, but there's other sequences where it's just so like, this is horrible. And
Patrick had made the point this summer, and now it might be true of every film ever made, that it seems to be two films fighting with each other for dominance. I agree about Bridesmaids. I laughed a lot. I thought it was really, really funny. I think, though, the fact that it made your list and it's making a lot of top 10 lists for the year says something about the state of comedy in American film. What's going on?
I think it stands a good chance of getting a Best Original Screenplay nomination. I don't think it'll win, but I think people love the movie. I think, again, it has the great story where it's Kristen Wiig and her friend wrote it, and she's the funny one who everyone loves on Saturday Night Live, and we have to recognize the movie. And I don't think it'll win, obviously, because Tom Cruise is going to win for Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol.
All the Oscars,
He has to take them all.
My favorite scene in Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol was where Tom Cruise makes the cupcake.
And poos in the sink. Every comedy that came out, I think, after Bridesmaids this year was measured against Bridesmaids.
These dipshit entertainment reporters, or even blogs, film blogs, and I think we're guilty of it too. I know what? I am sometimes. Every movie is a comparison to every other movie. Right. And if you find two things, like Drive will be compared to Fast Five. Those two things are apples and oranges.
Cars in both.
Right. Well, exactly. And that's, so people always want to compare things. So a comedy that comes out after Bridesmaids, and JB, to your point, it's on my list just because I was so pleasantly surprised and I had such a fun experience in the theater. And it was, it's weird. We always go back and look at our lists from previous years. Will it survive? I don't know, but it's a lot of fun. I actually look forward to watching it again on Blu-ray.
There are scenes in that movie that I think are so great. And it was, when I watch it again, it's like, oh, I wish the movie had more of this and less of,
Right.
But has anyone at the end of the year compared Drive to Cars 2? I think that's the critical comparison that they're missing out.
We're the first.
What number are we on?
Seven.
My number seven is Super, directed by James Gunn, which barely got released. We were fortunate enough to see it at the Music Box Theater in Chicago.
The happiest place on earth.
It got a release via video on demand. It's now available on DVD and Blu-ray. I think a lot of people, again, kind of wrote it off because, well, it looks like Kick-Ass, because it's about a regular guy who decides to be a superhero. But the two movies are completely different. Yeah. They're about completely different things, kind of to your point, where everything's a comparison.
Yeah.
They're not about the same thing at all. Super isn't even about superheroes at all. I mean, that's the...
It's a metaphor.
Right. Thank you. By which the story is told. It's great. It is very ambitious and kind of messy, and I think people have a hard time wrapping their heads around some of the shifts in tone in the movie. It's very funny, and then it's sort of shockingly violent, and then it goes back to being funny.
There's other scenes that are very disturbing in a very subtle way that we're not used to seeing in movies.
Right.
It's basically about what it's like to be dumped and how one recovers from that horrible experience.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I think it's also about, kind of trying to find your place in the world, which Attack the Block is sort of about, too. Mm-hmm. I think that each movie is sort of about its central character realizing a specific potential that he or she may have.
I actually saw this movie recently. Patrick was kind enough to let me borrow it on Blu-ray, and I watched it.
I am pretty kind.
You are a very kind, handsome...
Thank you.
But does he rewind?
No.
I liked it, and it didn't make my list, but I liked it a lot, and I think it'll grow on me. The more I've been thinking about it, I think Ellen Page's character is so funny, and just she's manic and crazy, and just
the most disturbing sex scene of the year.
Yeah, it's nuts. And the comedy, and James Gunn, of course, is Troma. He got to start in Troma movies, and there's certain scenes the violence is very Troma-esque, and there's certain scenes where the violence with Michael Rooker, that's all I'll say, is so not. And it's like, whoa, it makes me uncomfortable. There's some really funny pieces of dialogue too, like where she first introduces her name to Frank. She's Libby, and she says, "Don't make fun of my name." And then she proceeds to make fun of Frank's name, and it's drawn attention to, but it's done in such a way that's actually funny.
Right.
And like so many comedies, that when they draw attention to it, it's never funny. So,
oddly enough, my number seven is Super.
Hey, get out of town.
And Patrick and I saw it at the same time at the Music
Box. I wasn't invited.
I believe you were.
The saddest place on earth.
It's never the saddest place on earth.
It's right in here. I'm pointing to my heart, everyone.
I'm pointing to my penis.
On that note, so Patrick and I loved it, even though we both suffered from what I'm going to call the spoiler of the year in Mr. Ebert's review. Roger, did I love you.
But weren't you one of the people that I said, don't read Ebert's review?
And then
No, I think when you said that, I had already read it.
Okay, that's possible. Because there was more than one person that I said, don't read it. And then they're like, oh, I was so curious, I had to.
And then the... The comment that I think I shared with Patrick, I don't think I've ever said this on the podcast before. The curtain goes up and Super begins at the music box, and I knew I was going to love the film because the opening credit sequence is animated and it's made to look like very crude, hand-drawn pictures of superheroes, and suddenly they're doing a Bollywood musical number, and at the end of the credits, when it says directed by James Gunn, the music has stopped, and all of the characters are out of breath because they've been dancing, but they're drawings, and I said, I'm going to love this movie.
Definitely the best opening credits.
So Super was, guys, help me out, Super was, Patrick,
decent.
What? Not pustulant.
That's not what I was looking for.
Haywire.
Thank you.
Un-eagle-esque.
Thank you, sir.
Next for you, Douglas.
Okay, Scream 4. Listen.
Wes Craven. That is the other three screams.
Pulls back the curtain on...
Do you mean Hey Hey in the Hayloft? That's what I'm calling that film now. Wes Craven
has still got it, everyone.
Just like I'm calling the Psycho remake Clouds and Cows.
We're being meta.
My number six was The Descendants. Was Alexander Payne's The Descendants. I'm going to be douchebag for the rest of the podcast and say the director's name.
What have you been up until this point?
And I've been less of a douchebag.
Dougbag?
Dougbag. I've been Dougbag. That can be my new handle, Dougbag.
You mean on your CB radio?
That's right. 10-4, breaker, breaker. Smokey and the Dougbag. I saw The Descendants very recently, and it came out in December, I believe. And it's not perfect by any means. There's some big flaws. I don't like the Sid character. I don't like some of the voiceover dialogue. But there's, and again, I keep kind of saying this very simple point, which I don't need to repeat. There's certain scenes in that movie that broke my heart and really made me sad and made me tear up. And I think when a movie has the power to do that, I consider myself a very cynical, bitter, ironic person. And I am not affected by a lot of things. And certain elements did. It's no secret that in the movie, George Clooney's wife suffers from a boating accident.
Earmuffs.
And she's in a coma. And there's just a lot of great sequences. I say great, not like wonder. It's just really touching, haunting sequences. And you said something that I want you to repeat about Alexander Payne's direction.
But this doesn't sound funny, and I saw a trailer, and it seemed like it was a funny movie.
Well, he's running
about
his
a guy running in flip flops.
I've come to the conclusion that Alexander Payne makes the saddest comedies on earth.
Yeah,
but I really liked The Descendants. I thought it was manifestly better, and adjusted some of the things that I really thought were wrong with About Schmidt that he seems to have retooled. Because Citizen Ruth, Election, About Schmidt, The Descendants,
and Sideways,
that Election and Sideways did some things very, very well that I thought were overdone in About Schmidt. And in Descendants, he seems to pull it back. But again, why any of these films are advertised as comedies,
right.
It's the triumph of marketing because...
The same thing happened to Sideways. I remember people going to see it. Erica worked with some people who went to see Sideways expecting a comedy and came back very angry because it wasn't funny.
No, it's not funny at all. And that's great. It's sad and really...
It is funny at parts.
Yeah. It's never like, look how funny we're being. You know,
right,
it's just...
Right.
But Alexander Payne, I wanted you to say what you said to me.
Oh, just what I like about him. And it's something I noticed in Sideways. They were at a diner. And there was a waitress who was, you know, serving them. And I felt like she doesn't seem like an actress out of central casting. Like, this looks like a real diner that you would go to.
By the way,
California.
I've been to that diner.
And that's really who's serving
the
you.
Soul
and
Bang restaurant.
I like the way that he shoots America. I think he doesn't romanticize things in the way that movies so often do. And that is true of the way he shoots Hawaii in The Descendants, but it's also true of
an American high school in Election.
Right, or the way that he photographs the wife in a coma in The Descendants.
I'm glad you
touched on that. We are not used to seeing people in beds, you know, in hospitals, photograph the way that she is. It's
jarring.
It's harsh, but that's what this looks like.
And, and at one point, he keeps cutting to her hands, which have been molded around rolled-up washcloths. Mm-hmm. And that detail is sort of chilling and very evocative.
Absolutely. I like that you kind of said that. I almost think those are two points. And one, that he shoots locations.
Yeah.
Like, if you watch Just Go With It and they shoot Hawaii, it's so vibrant, it makes your eyes bleed.
Even Forgetting Sarah Marshall, which is a movie that we like.
I love that movie,
It looks like a tourist commercial. Right.
And he shoots this, and likewise, in Sideways, he's shooting the wine country, which you've only heard is just like these rolling lush greens of vineyards, and it's all just washed out beige, you know? Right. And then
the way that the sky looks in Sideways, looks like the actual sky, not a movie
sky. It's crazy. And again, there's certain scenes
not
that are,
life sky.
Not to give too much away, they're just so touching and heartbreaking to me. And I think the performances, I actually think the youngest daughter is very, is the younger, she seems like the younger sister of the girl in Spanglish.
Yeah, I thought that too. That's who she reminded me of.
And the older sister, I don't really know. I guess she was on she's a teeny bopper actress.
She's getting a lot of accolades.
Yeah. She
a
was
lot
really
of critics
decent.
Are suggesting that she gave the performance of the film.
Unfortunately, she's my niece, so I can't gawk too much.
The part is underwritten, but I found the scene where Robert Forster says goodbye to his daughter was very affecting.
It's shot through a cracked door.
And almost like what Patrick is saying about that it's not movie-like, that one feels that if this were really happening, this might be what it actually looks like to do this thing that we don't even want to think about.
Well, think about Jennifer Aniston in a hospital bed. I know we all do very often, but it would be perfect hair, perfect nails, and like, oh, maybe some beige under, or some gray under the eyes, but like perfect lipstick, and this is, I mean, there's even some like splotches on some white hospital. It's hard if you've gone through loss, but it's really touching, and I liked it a lot, and it stuck with me more than I thought. When I finished it, I was kind of like, oh, whatever, and then I just can't. I've been thinking about it a lot. So,
do you think George Clooney will get an Oscar?
No, of course not.
Because
Tom Cruise will get all the Oscars.
You.
I do think he might get nominated.
I think he'll be nominated for sure, but I don't know that.
Does he need one more Oscar? You think he needs one more Oscar?
You think we need one more? We'll get one more. My number six is Martha Marcy May Marlene, a movie that...
period.
It's a movie. JB. I really... It was a weird experience because I knew very little about it going in. I knew that it was about... it had one of the Olsen sisters, not one of the famous ones, and she has left a cult, and that's what I knew about the movie. And so I expected sort of this drama about reacclimating to society after having been part of a cult. And I pictured the indie movie version of what that sounds like in your head. And the movie is not that at all. And so it was jarring, and I was constantly having to adjust my expectations all the way through the very last shot, which is the thing that people are really talking about. Obviously I'm not going to give anything away. The audience that I saw it with felt very gypped by the end of the movie. I think the end of the movie really works and kind of sells you on what the whole movie has been. To your point, it's definitely one of the scariest movies of the year, because it is kind of made more like a Roman Polanski sort of horror movie than it is this indie drama about a cult.
And when I went to see it, I was expecting something like Ticket to Heaven, which is an obscure Canadian film about deprogramming cult members. But the cult that they present in that film is not something we've seen in a movie before, and it's so specific. And so, I don't want to say backwoods, but it's sort of this sort of DIY thing that, again, we've never seen before.
But it kind of eases you in, so at the beginning it's like, okay, I get why maybe this girl would find something to like here, and then they keep pulling it back a little bit more, and you get a new piece of information to, you know, the point where by the end you're sort of horrified by what's going on. But I really like the way that the movie is constructed. I like all the editing. It jumps around in time a lot in ways that can be disorienting, but again, that is part of the point of the movie.
I liked Elizabeth Olsen. I thought was phenomenal. And actually, I think I knew that it must be an Olsen. It was the Olsen twins' younger sister,
right?
But I forgot about that.
Right.
So, like, and
but
I'm glad
you remembered when in the movie she goes pizza,
P-I-Z-Z-A. I'm glad I forgot because I think I might have been distracted a little bit. And by not knowing that she's an Olsen twins' younger sister, I was able to be distracted by so much more that she brought to the screen. So thank you very much, Elizabeth Olsen. You should marry me.
The movie stayed with me for several weeks, and that's becoming more and more rare. It sort of wouldn't leave your head.
And that, again, which is sort of what Doug said at the beginning, that that all of the movies that we're talking about are sort of the movies that stayed with us. And that's one of the things that I thought was so interesting about this year. As everybody's lists come out, I like that the movies that are on everybody's list, I think, are movies that everybody has formed some sort of a personal connection with or that have stuck with you. It's not that we didn't see Tree of Life or The Artist or whatever. We saw those movies. They just didn't stick with us in the way that a movie like Super did, which was written off by all these other
people. And I think that it's so easy for people, and I don't want to sound like a Doug bag in saying this, but I think it's so easy for people to make a list of, I'll just use a list from like last year. Oh, King's Speech is number one, and The Fighter is number two.
The Social Network.
And it's like, well, those, you'll never be challenged on those. You can put out a list today of Tree of Life, The Artist, and lots of movies that haven't been released wide or in Chicago. And no one's going to be like, well, what? Why do you like that? And I think that that's just an easy way out. Not to say that people don't actually genuinely love those movies, but sure. To me it just seems disingenuous.
Right. What is next for you, Jay Bones?
I talked about this. Actually, we wound up talking about it at some length in the summer podcast and Doug's unfortunate confusion over this film. You guys haven't listened to the summer podcast recently. I just re-listened to it about a week ago. My next film on my list is Cave of Forgotten Dreams, the Werner Herzog film about some of the oldest cave paintings.
Today we're going into a cave. Is that how it sounds?
That's a pretty good
like Herzog. Some sort of proto-cinema. That's the line that sticks out to me. Because I like saying proto-cinema. That's just me doing Hugo Weaving as the Red Skull.
It's on Netflix Instant. I want to watch it, but you said that you need to watch it on a big.
I don't think you do.
Well, because you said that, I'm not going to watch it. I'm just kidding.
I enjoyed the fact that I got to see in a theater because some things don't come out to the suburbs. And Cave of Forgotten Dreams, I think it was at our suburban multiplex for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
In 3D, I think you can enjoy it not in 3D. I thought it was a really interesting use of 3D. I like documentaries to begin with, but I think it was the film that had more ideas in it or that encouraged me to meditate on what it was talking about more than any other film.
Was the theater crowded when you saw it?
About half full.
Not bad. Okay. Encouraging.
It got incredible reviews.
Yeah.
And again, and I mentioned this in a column a couple of weeks ago, the theater that Patrick and I frequent the most has 30 screens. Why they can't
devote, that's not a theater, that's an airport.
Why they can't devote one on a regular basis to something different?
No, they need.
It's just beyond me.
8 screens for Twilight, you know? Right. And actually, the theater that you're talking about has a Indian Pakistani population, which I think is kind of cool in that they do have some very boutique Bollywood stuff.
Sometimes there's 5 or 6, different Indian movies showing on a given week.
But how big is the smallest theater? Maybe 150 seats?
The smallest theater is very small.
You could definitely put an art house film in there and make a couple bucks. I don't get it. I completely agree with you. I want to check out that movie really badly.
In fact, for the longest time, and I know I've shared this with Patrick, I had this belief, this is a logical fallacy called faulty causality, that a movie that was a little special would not get out to the suburbs until I had gone into the city to see it.
Right.
Okay, Spotted Larry seen it? He went to Landmark Century?
Okay,
bring that up.
That used to happen to me a lot, too.
I had faulty causality last night, and my wife was none too pleased.
Douglas, what are we at?
Number five.
Five.
We're at the halfway point.
I don't use the expression Mr. Popper's Penguins. Listen. The movie was... Okay, you ever find yourself in a situation... Okay, wait.
Nicholas Fane, everyone. Nicholas Fane.
My number five was Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2.
A sequel?
A sequel of a sequel of a Part 7. I don't really need to talk about this. It was the last entry of the Harry Potter film franchise. I like this J.K. Rowling character. I think he's got a future. The movie, I thought, was very satisfying. I've read all the books. I'm a big nerd if I was 12.
You're a registered Potterphile.
I'm a Potterphile. You can look me up in a database. It is a satisfying conclusion. It does a lot of great things. I can't wait to see it. I just got it for Christmas, actually, on Blu-ray.
And will you go back and watch the part one first?
I will go back and probably watch all seven.
Oh, nice.
I want to do, like a weekend of just That's watching awesome. Harry Potter.
I like that.
Because
plan.
It does, and the books are like this, too. We've talked about this on Summer Podcast, I think. It does a thing where due credit to the author that it's a fun wizard school that becomes a crazy, dark, rainy, whatever. And it's a satisfying conclusion, and I really had a lot of fun. The theater was packed. People were sobbing,
weeping,
crying.
Yeah.
One girl was like, crying when a certain character dies. Harry Potter. And it was good. And when it was over, I was sad a little, but I was thinking to myself,
way to stick the landing.
Yeah, eight movies about one thing, and you think they're going to F up one or two, and none of them, I think, are really
None of them are bad.
Bad.
There are a few that that one's not as good.
As a compendium, it's excellent. Yep. So.
James Bond was not even able to do eight in a row.
Good Lord, right. No, because Roger Moore was born.
Sleep with my granddaughter.
I'm just borrowing your George Lazenby.
We did a whole show on Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2. If you want to hear more of Doug's thoughts on this film...
They're a little Doug baggy, but, stick with it.
That voice I was using was a little bit of my Albert Nobbs voice.
Albert Nobbs, which is funny, because that's your number five.
My number five!
At this point, we shift into Overblog.
Albert Nobbs! My number five is a movie that we talked a little bit about last week, because you named it as one of the underrated films of the year, and that is Lucky McKee's, to borrow a page from Doug, The Woman.
That's right. David Yates's Harry Potter. Sorry, go on.
A horror movie that barely was released, and I was very fortunate that it came out to the theater by us. It's out on Blu-ray and DVD in a couple of weeks. It is a polarizing movie. It is a movie that makes some very, very sort of bold choices aesthetically. I'm thinking specifically of the music. It goes to some crazy places. It is not a subtle movie. It says a lot of the things. It says a lot of the same things that Sucker Punch has to say, which I think we talked about last week, and The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. But of the three, The Woman is my favorite. For me, it's the best horror movie of the year. I just think it's really, really great. And some really great performances, and then some performances that are not great, but it all kind of
balances.
It's a mixed bag. Mixed Doug bag.
It's kind of a messy movie, but it's...
I thought the mess was part of the point.
Right. I am well on record as liking a mess.
And again, thanks to Patrick's recommendation, I ran to the theater and actually saw it before it closed, and I got to see it in
less
movie
than
theater,
a week.
So
yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah.
A lot of it stuck with me. I saw it with you. Thanks for that.
You're welcome.
If my text after Sucker Punch was "What the f was that," I could apply that same thing to The Woman, but in the best possible way. It's like it's batshit crazy. There's excellent. I mean, it's very douchey to say a character has a fearless performance, and you talk about this ad nauseum in your review on the website. Pollyanna McIntosh as The Woman is. I don't know how you do that. I really don't. I'm like embarrassed sometimes if I, cut myself shaving and she's, out there showing her bush and everything, it's all dirty and
full spano.
She absolutely.
Goes full spano.
So it was, it's crazy. I really like it.
I think it's really,
and you cannot recommend it to anyone.
Yeah.
You know?
That's the thing. It's not a movie for everyone. The night we watched it, I actually went on IMDb and read some of the comments underneath, and that is...
Why would you do that?
That's just a black hole, but right there, you get both sides. There's people saying, this is great and underrated, but then you have a lot of people saying, this is sexist and horrible. Anyone who likes this is an idiot, All those people have everything spelled wrong, by the way. I think it's a really, really good movie, and it's one worth seeking out. And if you don't love it, that's okay, but you should see it.
Read Patrick's review on the website.
Thank you.
For the longest time, I thought I couldn't include this film because it was disqualified for some reason. But as other critics' 10 best lists of the year started coming out, it started popping up on a fairly regular basis, and I'm like, yes! Because it wasn't released in the United States until 2011. And here I'm talking about 13 Assassins.
Ah, yes.
Which we saw at the Music Box.
Yes.
The Happiest Place on Earth. An amazing film, an amazing action film. I know Patrick sometimes says he loves it when a film shows him things he's never seen before. And again, I was talking to my son on the phone earlier today, and he said, when have you ever seen a film that has fight sequences that are so long that it includes a part where the participants are have to stop right. because they're exhausted
I can't
from
wait
sword
to see
fighting.
This.
And it's structured in a very interesting way. It has an hour setup that's actually fairly slow and fairly complicated, and then
it takes off.
All hell breaks loose, and the entire last hour is a fight.
Unbelievable.
With things, what is the animal they set on fire?
It's like a bull or a cat, wasn't it?
At one point, there's a stampede of bulls, and they're all on fire. And that apparently was a weapon back then.
Well,
because
it's very inventive, because again, the central thing in the movie is that it's these 13 guys taking on an army of hundreds, and so they have to find all these different ways to get an advantage, and one of them is setting animals on fire.
It's like historic, right? It's like an old, or is it a new?
No. It's the siege.
Samurai. It's the siege scene in Seven Samurai on steroids.
Right.
Wow.
And
Mark Ahn put that on his top 10 list.
He did.
Also.
Yeah. It's available on Netflix Instant. You should all watch it. This is not my point. I don't remember where I heard this recently, but somebody pointed out about that second hour that it's really good about sort of letting you know not where you are geographically, but you understand the progress that is being made. Like if there's 250 guys that they have to take out, you understand. They're like, okay, about 100 have been taken out so far. You understand when they're sort of reaching the conclusion.
I assume there's a counter in the bottom right corner.
Ding, ding, ding.
With the death meter.
And I would suggest the best villain of the year.
Yeah, and I especially love his fate. Because it's really un-Hollywood, but very satisfying.
It's a really, really, really good movie. Everybody see it. Yay!
I will. I'll see it tonight.
Nice.
Thank you.
Next for you, sir.
Number four, Larry Crown. Listen, it's very good, and everyone should see it.
They join a scooter gang.
Today is opposite day. Number four for me is Drive. But I'm gonna try and say his name. Nicholas Winding Refn.
I believe it's just Winding, but...
When you say Refn. It sounds like a James Bond villain.
Nicholas Winding Refn.
Mr. Bond, you're a stupid policeman.
I'm very Danish. Drive is excellent, and I can't even begin to talk about what it means or what it's about, and that's not really for me to say.
That's because it's about nothing, but I'll get to that in a minute.
I loved how it made me feel. I loved... Ryan Gosling, it's no secret that boys and girls both love him. He is the best, and he does a great performance. There's a whole, I mean, something that's been talked about, and I'll talk about it some more, is the opening chase sequence in vigorous finger quotes, in that it's not a chase sequence. It's outsmarting the police just with knowing the streets and stopping and hiding and then moving and then doing this and doing that.
And how many car chases have you seen in movies? And I check out during every single one. And it's
absolutely.
Like, oh, look, someone found a new way to do a car chase.
And it's you're like, holy shit, is he going to get away with this?
And the end of it is really clever.
It's almost
and
as
makes
if...
makes the very beginning payoff where he's watching a game on TV. Like,
you know,
oh, now I get it.
This might sound really dumb. You know in a horror movie when there's a killer, but at first it just sounds and you don't know what door he's behind. And that's the part that's the scary part.
Right.
When the killer reveals himself and has the knife and he's actually chasing Jamie Lee Curtis, it's less scary, even though it's still very scary. To me, that's a chase scene. It's like, I know the guy is right behind him. It's just a matter of if they're going to get away. And this is like, you don't know where they are. You don't know where it's so inventive. And
you perk up because you're like, hey, I've never seen this before. Right. I want to pay attention.
Albert Brooks is excellent.
Everybody's excellent.
I thought Albert Brooks particularly, and again,
like Tom Waits in it. He's in that, right? Tom Waits.
I'm pretty sure.
I don't want to engage in spoilers.
That's Carey Mulligan.
There's a scene late in the film. There's a scene late in the film between Albert Brooks and Bryan Cranston that really bothered me, like really shook me up the way it was presented, and it stayed with me. And especially because the film is actually presenting that as kindness.
Yeah. Let's just say he was Breaking Bad.
I don't even know what that means.
I don't either. Let's just say he was no longer Malcolm in the Middle.
There's now this drive backlash.
Really?
Yeah.
Drive bash? Back drive. No.
That there's a lot of people who are saying it's nowhere near as good as people are saying it.
That's a shame, because it's a lot of fun, and it's serious and not at all Fast Five. If you're expecting Fast Five, that is not the movie.
No, Land to Sue.
I agree with you completely. It's my number two film.
And it's my number three.
Oh, spoilers! Sorry, Doug.
But before we get to that, my number four is Young Adult, otherwise known as Young Adult, directed by Jason Reitman, and written by, from the mind of Diablo Cody.
Jennifer's body's Diablo Cody?
I thought, it really took me by surprise at how much I liked it. I've liked Jason Reitman's movies, but it's interesting because I don't think he's made a singularly great movie, but when you sort of already consider his body of work, he's really sort of putting an impressive resume together. I just thought it was a really interesting character study about somebody who is essentially unlikable, but still... we were talking about this a little bit yesterday, that the success of the movie, I think, is that Charlize Theron is not just this cartoon monster. She is unlikable and self-absorbed and shallow and awful, but you recognize pieces of her in people you know, maybe even in parts of yourself.
That's what struck me too. She's a female. I mean, obviously it's all the female, kind of the worst traits of a female. Like, she is a Kardashian in a way, you know, but there's parts of her that I identified with, and I'm a guy, I'm like alpha male, like ball swinging guy. And I identified with this very dainty lady.
Really good performances, really good dialogue, goes to some dark places that a lot of movies aren't necessarily willing to go. I don't want to talk about the ending, but I thought it was really good.
I enjoyed the film. I had some problems with the casting. I had some problems with the dialogue, actually. I think Patton Oswalt gives one of the performances of the year. I actually thought that would have been a more interesting film if it had been about the Patton Oswalt character.
That's interesting. I don't agree with that, but I think Patton Oswalt is I can't stop hearing Remy from Ratatouille. And I know that's not his fault. That's his voice. Like, he didn't obviously do a cartoon voice for a rat in a cartoon.
I think there's some very subtle things he's doing in Young Adult that he should be given credit for. And again, this comes up again and again and again. The Patton Oswalt character in his situation, that's not a character I've ever seen in a movie before.
Right, yeah. Next for you, JB.
Midnight in Paris.
Yes.
Went back and forth. Is it overrated? Is it underrated? People love Midnight in Paris.
Turns out it's just rated.
Or are they just enjoying it because they're patting themselves on the back, forgetting the literary references, and Time Out Chicago reviews it and loves it, and 3 months later reviews it and shits on it, so that defines the backlash. I don't think Midnight in Paris is trying to be anything other than what it is. It's a very small, little, romantic trifle.
Yeah.
And I loved it. In much the same way that Hugo did, it took me back to a place that I honestly wish I could visit and talk to Ernest Hemingway, and I loved it a lot. It's my number four film.
I like a lot of what it has to say, too, about nostalgia and just how we all long to live in the past, but it's not necessarily, when you apply that practically, it's not a good idea.
Yeah, absolutely.
What's next for you, Doug?
Cowboys and Aliens is not my number three movie. My number three movie is Young Adult.
Yay! I was just talking about that. Were you here?
I was, and okay. I bit my tongue.
Oh, are you okay?
No, my mouth is full of blood, which means I have to leave. Young Adult, I saw very recently, and I agree with everything you just said.
Thank you.
And but one thing I want to say is I noticed in a couple movies this year that I really like, Descendants, one of them, and Young Adult, one of them, that it does these cinematic things where it has these crazy situations and or very cinematic. I wish there was another word I'm looking for. You can help me out. Just structured situations that don't really happen in real life.
Right.
In Young Adult, there's a sequence where Charlize Theron confronts not really confronts, but like has a big scene with the wife of her ex-boyfriend from high school. And the scene itself is like, this would never happen. There's people that are crowded around them watching them act like assholes. Or specifically her, actually, the wife and her ex-boyfriend have some... And my point is... and let me just say also, in Descendants, there's a scene in which George Clooney talks to his daughter's boyfriend, who is my least favorite character in the movie. His name is Sid. He is just... He's there for comic relief, I think.
And yet it turns out he has some wisdom.
Right. But my point is this.
Who saw that coming?
We have these crazy scenes where, like, a father is asking his daughter's boyfriend for it. What would you do, Sid? I'm like, this would never happen. My point is, in these crazy, fantastical situations, I thought that the dialogue was better than the situation. I thought that it kind of pulled it pulled the plot through, it pulled everything through. And I loved, in Charlize Theron in Young Adult, she's, just freaking out, and they're not responding the way that she wants them to respond, meaning they're not pissed at her. And she's like, why don't you hate me? And they all feel sorry for her. And it's such a, like...
And that for me is the turn that brings so much of the movie into focus.
Yeah.
When Patrick Wilson says that to her. But.
Right. So I thought, and again, there's so much of, I mean, honestly, I've been thinking about that movie. I keep saying I've been thinking about this movie a lot, but really, like, I go back to thinking about my high school days, because I'm a little younger, I think, than the characters in the movie, but all the songs are from our era, Patrick, in high school
era,
and all of that feeling, even though I honestly don't remember high school as well as you know, pointedly as she does,
right.
So much of that is...
Because those weren't your best years, as they were for her.
Absolutely. You know? But you should definitely see it. Don't expect a comedy, but expect something that's going to... I think Diablo Cody gets a bad rap from me, too, and she is a really good screenwriter. I can't wait to see Untitled Diablo Cody project.
It doesn't do all the dialogue things that drove people crazy in Juno. And again, I think she lays some stuff out there that I think the movie is in some ways autobiographical. I think there are details in that movie that are well observed enough that I don't think she's just making them up. And I think that... I think she lays herself out there in a way that is to be commended. I don't know.
Also, Charlize Theron is very pretty.
my number three is Drive, which we sort of already talked about. Maybe for me the best directed movie of the year, because that movie is all direction. It's just all about the choices. It's about the shots and the lighting and the music and the way it's cut together. The performances are very good. You know, Drive kept moving up and down on my list because I wanted to put it very high because I think it's so great and I had such a good time watching it, and it's one of the few movies that I have seen more than once. It's so well done, but every time I just kept saying, but it's not really about anything. It's just sort of about surfaces, and they're great surfaces.
It's about an hour and a half.
Yeah, all right. but ultimately, I couldn't put it much lower than three because it's just great.
And as I said, Drive is my number two. My number three, I believe, we'll be talking about in about 4 minutes.
Okay.
My number three film was Super 8.
All right.
Absolutely.
Which I enjoyed. Not as much as Patrick, who is
but
thinking
more than
about
me.
Making it his religion. As I pointed out, because Patrick and I did a podcast on the movie over the summer. You can check that out.
But then you'll hear the Quibbler.
See?
And you'll hear me with a cold.
Happy sad that...
Hello, I'm Patrick Brown.
I love the movie Super 8.
That I thought it was interesting that we finally get a big-budget summer blockbuster that's about me. That's about my preteen days, because that kid in that movie, that's me.
That's how I felt when I saw Thor.
Because I used to make little Super 8 movies. One day, Patrick and Doug will get lucky enough, and I will show them the version that I made with my buddies one summer week on a suburban Arlington Heights street using my house of Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Nice.
And I even made it in black and white.
Outstanding.
And it was a lot more expensive for the processing because they were doing so much less black. Anyway, that's why Super 8's on my list, because it's about me. And I don't even need the film to have a final half hour. I'm happy enough with everything until the train crashes.
That's about 20 minutes.
Third on my list is the first 20 minutes of Super 8, which really points out how bad the entirety of every other movie was this year.
Oh, wow.
That 20 minutes of this one film can trump something like, just go with it.
Number two, Douglas.
Columbiana is not a movie people talk about in
You are honestly going to make that fucking joke 10 times yeah. tonight.
Why do you think I'm looking at my phone?
I'm impressed because each choice.
I'm trying not to choose the Smurfs.
Exactly.
I'm trying
not each choice has been spot on.
No. Believe it or not, once I thought you were serious. I forget which one, but there was one I was like, oh shit.
Mr. Popper's Penguins, was it?
No, it wasn't.
My number two is Midnight in Paris. I think you had seen it before I did, JB, and you loved it. You said it was great. And I remember thinking to myself, I don't really know much about this movie. It wasn't marketed.
I know what time it takes place at, and I know where it happened.
It wasn't marketed. It kind of had a slow build.
And I can't believe that the trailer didn't give it away.
Yeah. Thankfully, right. This slow build, though, where I saw some commercials for it, and I'm like, what is this? You don't really get a great picture of what it is. It just takes place in Paris, and it's Owen Wilson, who I'm not usually, like, the biggest fan of. And you had seen it and loved it. And I'm like, and it was one night where my wife and I were going to go see a movie. And I think there was two options and she was leaning towards that. I'm like, no, we're going to go see Midnight in Paris. And it was the first movie I saw this year. After seeing a couple at the end of 2010, it was the first one I saw in 2011. When did it come out? In the spring or the early summer, right?
Probably. Yeah.
Where I was just delighted. I just sat there and smiled the entire time. I just had a smile plastered on my face. And who cares about why the things happen, why they happen. I love the ending.
A delicious little chocolate.
There's something, Hugo is not on my list. I know it's on yours. But Hugo takes place in Paris, but it doesn't feel like Paris to me. Midnight in Paris feels like Paris. And I realize
you know what feels like Paris to me? From Paris with Love.
Is that with John Travolta?
Yeah.
You know what feels like Paris to me? Plaster of Paris, oddly enough.
His feel. You like the feel.
There's an expression you don't hear very much anymore.
No, I'm a Kiss fan.
I'm also not a fan of Woody Allen. And that's not to say I'm not a fan of his. I don't even know enough about him. I've seen probably 10 of his movies.
Them were Curse of the Jade Scorpion.
Eight of them were Eyes Wide Shut. What? That's not a Woody Allen movie.
He's made some very mediocre films in the last 20 years.
Right.
He's made like over 40 movies.
I've seen what I should see, and I probably am missing. I know I haven't seen Manhattan, but I have seen enough of the garbage where I'm just kind of like, what is the big deal? And it's also this notion that people that are into film, especially when I was in college, Woody Allen was the Boondock Saints of the 90s, and it was like, you got to love Woody Allen. And he's, I don't. You know,
Annie Hall and Manhattan are coming out on Blu-ray in just a couple weeks.
Great.
That is good news.
Yeah.
My number two is I Saw the Devil, a Korean revenge film directed by Kim Ji-woon. Also available on Netflix Instant for those of you who are strong of stomach. Not necessarily a horrendously gory movie, but definitely an intense movie. Definitely a violent movie. Saw it by myself very late one night at the Music Box, and it's one of the few times where I was a little bit nervous walking back to my car on the deserted city street at night because it's a movie that kind of shakes you up.
Southport, the scariest street, and watch out for that bistro! I only say that, massive tangent. When I was in high school and I started to go to the Music Box, that neighborhood was a demilitarized zone.
Right.
It's Paris now.
Yeah, it absolutely is.
But this shows you how scary and intense the movie was. I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. It's just it's incredible how far the movie is willing to go, and that's sort of the point of the movie. It's almost like Peter Jackson's King Kong.
Yes,
when King Kong is fighting the dinosaurs, and you're just like, oh my god, it just keeps going and topping itself, and this isn't over yet. That's I Saw the Devil, except it's two guys trying to kill each other. It's great, and everybody should see it.
I thought it was with Lindsay Lohan, and she was a stripper.
That's I Know Who Killed Me.
Oh, right.
I Saw the Devil.
And this is one of my regrets for the year. I guess I was so busy running
seeing
to some movie theater.
Other movies.
It's on Blu-ray.
Yes.
The Blu-ray has been on this shelf.
Yes.
He's pointing to the shelf. When did that Blu-ray come out?
A couple months ago.
Yeah. I got to see it.
Longer than that. I bet it was summer.
That's
Maybe.
It seems like I bought it a long time ago.
Yeah. It's great. It's my second favorite movie of the year.
Not the best, but pretty great.
JB,
number two.
My number two is Drive, which I think we've discussed.
Okay. My number two. Am I at number one?
You're at number one. Here it is, everyone.
Here's the final joke.
Drum.
Lest you think this would actually be my number one. Bucky Larson born to be a star. Come on. Come on. Come me some slack. I'm trying to like bring some levity and humor and humor to the podcast.
It's been a dour affair. It's been a miserable award. Seeing the devil.
My number one, which deserves one of all of the Oscars,
yes,
is Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol.
Your favorite movie of the year.
Is a mainstream...
A sequel to a John Woo movie.
That's right. Who'd have thunk it? It is so freaking entertaining and fun and exciting and never stops moving. It's directed by Brad Bird, whose previous credits were all cartoons.
Yeah.
He was the creative director for The Simpsons.
Yeah.
I just finished this great Simpsons book. It's the unauthorized history of The Simpsons, and he's referenced a lot in it, and then he did Iron Giant and then two Pixar movies. And this is his first one, and he directs. I think you said this before, Patrick. Like, he has something to prove. He
directs the shit out of that.
Yeah,
movie.
Absolutely. It's so fun. Simon Pegg is funny, but not like, hey, I'm Tom Arnold in True Lies. You know,
right.
It's exciting. The set pieces. It's a travelogue, as you pointed out. I think after I saw you the night I saw it,
it's a $10 vacation.
It is, and it's the things like that sandstorm. I've never seen anything like that before. The cars falling down in Mumbai in that. Automated
the parking garage.
Parking garage.
Which people have a problem with. And I think people are reacting to the fact that, you know, arguably the best set piece is in the middle of the movie. But I sort of appreciate the fact that it's like, okay, we're going to stick this in the middle and then we're going to keep going.
And it doesn't... Like,
because I think that parking garage sequence is very inventive.
You never lose
energetic.
Track. And even like, there's always, in movies like this, there's always an element of like, what the hell is going on? Who even knows who's against who and where the missiles are going and all this stuff.
Right.
And you get it, and you don't really need to know everything, but you still, more than any other movie like this, I feel like I know what's going on. I know who has to do what.
And I can't remember the last time I saw an action film with more great set pieces.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely the best action movie in a long time. And to go back to what I just said about King Kong and the Dinosaurs, that's Mission Impossible 4 also, in that the movie just keeps having things go wrong, and it keeps sort of putting the screws to this team of people, and they have to keep figuring a way out of their situation.
I want
to
watch it right now, I swear to Christ.
And this is a tangent that's not really a tangent, because as most of you know, my son is currently enrolled in film school, and we're both big fans of two books that David Mamet wrote about the craft of drama. And it seems to me everyone in Hollywood should be made to read those books.
I think I've read both of those, yeah.
Three Uses of the Knife, Four Uses of the Knife?
I think it's Three Uses.
Three Uses of the Knife and Bambi Meets Godzilla.
Yeah.
And because Hollywood has lost sight of what drama is.
Mm.
And as Mission Possible, a Ghost Protocol, keeps reminding us over and over and over again, no, it's more interesting if he doesn't get it.
Right.
And it seems so simple, and yet Hollywood films are incapable of doing it.
And it keeps finding ways to sort of tweak the tropes of the past movies, whether it's the message doesn't self-destruct, the masks don't work, you know, little touches.
The masks thing, because I remember the original television show when I was a kid growing up that was obsessed with these impossible masks. All of the things about the masks in Ghost Protocol is very clever.
They do some throwbacks to the TV show. The music, the score is very kind of, you know, it's like that. The two last things I'll say about this is, one, I saw, obviously, before the movie was a trailer for Dark Knight Rises. And the coming attractions conundrum
by JD
kicked in a little bit. But in any other movie, I would have been like, why am I wasting my time with this? I got to see Dark Knight Rises. And a pleasant surprise is you get to see Ghost Protocol, which is excellent.
Right.
And two, I don't really recommend movies to my family because they have different tastes and, you know, their busy lives and whatever
else. You
should
tell them to see The Woman.
Yeah, right. I told my sister and her husband, who I'm very close to, you got to see this movie. And I felt comfortable saying this, not like they would quite, like I told them to see Sideways and they didn't like, you know, they're
it was not funny.
Right, absolutely. And they saw it and they loved it. And then my brother-in-law admitted to me that this is the first movie they had seen in a theater since Speed.
Which I think is interesting because I think Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol does a lot of the things that Speed does really well, in that it keeps inventing new problems that have to be overcome.
What I like most is that the Tom Cruise, while driving to his Oscar, is in a bus that will not go slower than 55 miles per hour.
I've been recommending Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol to strangers on the street.
I think the backlash is starting to kick in a little bit already, especially among sort of the fanboy community, who are just kind of like, I don't see what the big deal is because people like us are talking it up so much. But it's making a lot of money, and I'm happy about that.
Absolutely. Because I want Brad Bird does a lot. I think his next movie is 1906. It's about the San Francisco earthquake.
No, thank you. I want more Mission Impossible movies. But only
gotta,
make those.
You got to say this about Brad Bird. It's very unusual, especially in the last 30 years. He's hit 4 home runs in a row.
Yeah. Patrick, number one movie of all time.
My number one will sort of be talked about, I think, a little bit in tandem with JB's number one, because I think we have similar experiences with different movies. My number one, it is no secret. I've been talking about it for...
Real quick, why am I left out of this little cabal of closeness
and
community?
Because your choice is wrong. You picked the wrong movie. I've been talking about it for probably 6 months. My number one movie of the year is Super 8. I won't necessarily argue that it's the best movie of the year, but it's hands down my favorite movie of the year. I wanted to see it more than anything else this year. Surprisingly, it did not let me down. I thought the trailer was great. Usually I'm let down. Super 8 lived up to my expectations. I've only grown to like it more the more times I see it. I'm aware that it is a movie with flaws, but I'm at a point now where I'm rationalizing those flaws as successes, where I'm saying, no, the alien, it's really because of this, and I'm making up reasons for the alien, but like I said at the beginning of the podcast, everybody has a very, very personal connection to their favorite movies this year, and no movie do I feel more personally connected to than Super 8.
And I was rationalizing the flaws in my choice for number one the minute the lights came up in the theater, although I will say this doesn't happen very often anymore. And again, Patrick and I saw this film in the same screening. When it was over, many audience members applauded, which doesn't happen very much. My favorite movie of the year was Hugo. I realized, well, to some people it's a very conventional choice. To me, it was a very personal choice. I've been teaching film study for almost 30 years. George Melies has always been a really important part of the first couple weeks of class. And so that spoke to me, although I think I benefited from the fact that going to see it, I really had no idea what it was about. Mm-hmm. I completely avoided any sort of specific trailer review. I knew it was about a little boy in France, and the trailer actually made me believe it was about his friendship with a robot man.
Like Bicentennial Man, right?
Right.
I thought it was about a train station and a boy being chased by a dog.
So...
In 3D!
I thought it was very much like a very good children's storybook. I like how all the subplots tied into the central metaphor of the film, which is, what is machinery for other than to help us achieve our dreams? And I thought that was well tied together with George Melies, who was sort of one of the fathers of film. Obviously, in the spirit of Midnight in Paris, the film enabled me to vicariously go back in time and spend time with Melies, not only when he was finally recognized as the genius he was, but also the film has a flashback where Scorsese spends a lot of money recreating what it might have been like to be in that studio. And then the cherry on the sundae is they reprocess the famous shot in Trip to the Moon so that it was in 3D. So that was a treat. Many, many years ago, one of my film study students found a plaster... I don't want to call it a statue. It's a plaster wall hanging.
Like a relief.
Yeah. I'm guessing it was homemade, but you can't tell if it was homemade or who on earth would have manufactured this, of the moon with the rocket ship stuck in the eye. And the student found it at a garage sale and bought it for me. And that's been up in my classroom for the last 10 years. So this film was made for me.
Yeah.
And I think I cried for the entire last 45 minutes, and it's not because the film is particularly sad. I thought it was very heartwarming that Melies was finally recognized in the narrative of the film, but it was just fucking amazing to me that Scorsese was taking me on this journey that I wish I could make.
And I've said this before, Hugo was not on my list or whatever, I believe. As you put it, when the movie was over, I resisted its... I forget what you said. Are you resisting this movie's charm? I don't remember what you said. But as soon as it ended, knowing that, I was seeing it with you, I knew that it was... Shit, what am I trying to say?
Well, because you heard my sobs.
Right. I knew that the movie was working for you. Like, when you said that movie was made for me, I knew that. Even watching it, I'm like, this movie is made for JB. And it made me, even if I didn't love the movie, it makes me happy to know that there are movies out there that we connect with so personally. That it made me happy to know that there was a movie that was made just for you.
But here's an interesting caveat. And maybe years from now, I'll look back and I'll say, oh, I picked that. I don't think I ever need to see it again.
Interesting.
That it's one of those that I got it.
Okay.
And I don't think any rescreening could possibly recapture what I got the first time.
Interesting.
And that I would be desperately afraid that if I were to ever see it again.
Weird. Okay.
That what?
It would lessen the original experience.
So you're always chasing the dragon?
No, I really like that metaphor we came up with for horror fans. I think that's what you're referring to.
I don't know.
No, Doug is referring to heroin.
Heroin, yeah.
Months and months ago,
we compared
horror fans to heroin addicts. And at a very young age, they got something very, very special that's rare. And they keep going to these horrible horror films because they're chasing the dragon. That seeing it again might tell me that it's nowhere near as good as that magical first screening did. And on the other hand, though, we had arguably the worst seats in the house.
Yeah.
For Hugo.
And my feelings about the film may have been affected by that.
And they had it in a way too small theater for how popular it is. We got there late. I mean, really, it's in 3D, and we are in the worst seats on Earth. And even that didn't stop me.
Yeah. And I have had the opposite experience with Super 8, and I've made mention of this many times, where now I put it on, and Michael Giacchino's score kicks in just over the Paramount logo, and the Amblin logo comes up, and the Bad Robot, and the Super 8 suite is playing, and I already kind of start to cry, no matter how many times I watch it. And I've watched it a bunch.
You guys are big pussies. I don't get this podcast.
That's the point of this
podcast. Listen, all I think, it's funny that your two favorite movies are flawed, and there's caveats. And my favorite movie is
awesome.
Perfect.
Your movie's awesome. But these are better. Even though they're not great, they're perfect.
Okay, if I can explain. Our favorite movies are flawed apples. Your favorite movie is a perfect orange.
I prefer pears, but whatever.
So that's it. That's our 2011.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
Thanks for listening, everybody. And now we're going to get back to doing our favorite movie series on our run up to 100 shows, which is only a few shows away.
Please keep emailing us your favorite moments from the website and the podcast, because we're getting very close to awarding some fantastic prizes.
And JB's box of loot only continues to grow.
Oh my God, I'm going to steal some
more
stuff from
titles
it.
Have been
excellent.
Added literally since last week when we talked about was in the stash.
It's no secret. JB owns tens of thousands of DVDs and Blu-rays, and he is
Criterion Hitchcock in here, people.
I'm juggling them right now.
There won't be. Shut your face, Patrick. I am totally switching that out for my snap case of North by Northwest.
Probably true, everyone. That will not be in the box.
Spoilers.
Anyway.
Oh, keep posting, keep emailing, and also post your top 10 lists below. We love to see the comments below all the posts.
Yeah, that's really great. Definitely.
Spoilers for 2012. Favorite movies, it's a haywire route.
It's a shutout.
It's haywire. A shutout.
If you're going to be watching the Golden Globes this week, also make sure you follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/fthismovie, while someone...
Yes.
Can I say?
Sure.
Doug live tweets the Golden Globes.
We'll see
and
how that goes.
If you live in Michigan, Sunday morning, listen to me talk about Ricky Gervais hosting on the radio.
Also, one final thing, because I saw so many gosh darn movies in a movie theater.
We get it.
In 2011. My first movie of 2012 was Melancholia.
Okay.
And now I'm so depressed. That will be the only movie I see in a theater.
Why would that depress you? It had a happy ending.
That means you won't see Haywire.
It had a happy ending. All the people didn't have to be miserable anymore.
The magic tent works, everyone!
I'm afraid I just want my sister to try to give me a bath and fail.
That was one of my favorite scenes. I had two favorite scenes. I take it back.
Bye, everybody.
Expecto Patronum!